I'll thank again, Yuan, for inviting me over to give a talk. The topic I'm going to talk about, perhaps there are some experts in the audience who can say much more than what I can about the field, about the experiments I present, or the models I'm going to use, so please feel free to comment throughout the talk. I'll be accepting comments gratefully. So this is a work I did together with Dror Gad, my thesis advisor at the Hebrew University, and with Yosef Kaplan, his current student. Some are not familiar with the phenomena, with cuprate phenomena. So just a brief introduction. Cuprates are superconducting materials, and from a structural point of view, they all have a common feature, which is important for most of the physics we like to discuss. These are these copper oxide layers, copper atoms sitting at the points on a square lattice, and oxygen atoms sitting between them. And this is common for all these throughout these materials. And all the interesting physics, most of the interesting physics happens here. Let's focus on the phase diagram, generic phase diagram of the cuprates. So we usually draw it as a function of temperature and doping. The parent compound, the undoped compound, we have one electron on each copper atom. And they order antiferromagnetically. It's a Mott insulator, rather well understood. But then what the interesting things happen when you start removing charges from the system by doping. So we introduce some holes in the system, and then the charges can move around. Very quickly, antiferromagnetism is destroyed. And soon afterwards, we enter a superconducting phase at low enough temperatures. So here we see what's called a superconducting dome. Many other interesting phenomena occur in this intermediate region at higher temperatures, under the generic name of pseudo-gap phenomena. A lot of experiments, a lot of theoretical studies, it's very difficult to kind of exhaust everything, and that's definitely not what I'm going to try to do now. What I want to focus on today is this region of short-range charge density wave correlations, which have been observed over the recent years in various experiments, mostly in this underdoped pseudo-gap regime. Now, just to warn you, our approach will be phenomenological. I'm not going to consider microscopic details for why various tendencies occur. We'll just try to see from a phenomenological point of view how much we can how much of the experimental results we could describe from just from phenomenological considerations. So. There are a number of experiments that show these short-range charge density wave tendencies. Perhaps the most direct experimental evidence is hard X-ray diffraction. You see a scattering peak at some incommensurate wave vector seen over here. And in this, on the right side, we see the intensity of the peak as a function of temperature and for various magnetic fields here for YBCO. Most of the results we'll present will be for YBCO, but some also from other materials. The order is short range, so the peak has a finite width. This indicates that there's no long range order. The order is finite within the planes, like here we have 25 unit cells, more or less. This is at low temperatures. For these parameters, it's also confined more or less to one layer. So the correlation is the correlations are two-dimensional under these conditions and extend over finite distance within the layer. These results are not only in YBCO, but you have similar experimental signals observed in other cuprates. So we have here bismuth and the lanthanum and also mercury-based cuprates. Okay. Now, it's important to understand that not any occurrence of charge density wave in the cuprates comes from the same origin. So just to see this, I have here a comparison between YBCO and LBCO compounds. In LBCO, there's a known stripe phase where charges move within the stripes, and this also forms a stripe spin structure. And as a function of doping, we see that the wave, here we see the wavelength of these density waves as a function of doping. So the wavelength of both the charge density wave and the spin density wave in the LBCO grow as a function of doping. On the other hand, if we look at YBCO, they have opposing trends. This is just comes to show us that the phenomena could have different origin. We're not necessarily discussing a phenomenon of the same origin. So there are different occurrences of charge density wave in the cuprates. Other evidence for charge order in the cuprates have been seen in STM experiments, scanning tunneling experiments. They measure local charge density using a tip which has a high resolution. On the left side, we see this is important for the talk. On the left side, we see early tunneling results by Jennifer Hoffman, who put a superconductor in a magnetic field. Now, when you put a superconductor in a magnetic field, the magnetic field penetrates the superconductor through vortices. This is type 2 superconductor. And usually, in such a case, when you use try to tunnel into states in the presence of a magnetic field, you see accessible states in the center of each vortex core. Here, there are accessible states, but you see that actually they have this kind of checkerboard pattern. So this is an indication that when you destroy superconductivity locally in the vortex, you see that the electrons try to order themselves in some kind of spatially modulated structure. Similar checkerboard or perhaps some kind of pneumatic stripe phase have been seen in larger scale STM experiments more recently. So we've discussed the occurrence of charge density waves in cuprates. There are also other interesting phenomena that are seen in underdoped cuprates, and these, for example, there are signatures of superconductive fluctuations above the critical temperature. In a conventional superconductivity, when you increase the temperature, pairing disappears and you're into a normal state. In the cuprates, there are experiments that show that pairing still survives above the critical temperature, and the only reason the superconductor is not the system is not superconducting is because phase fluctuations. So one way to probe local pairing correlations is a diamagnetic signal. If you see a diamagnetic signal, is you generally is a strong indication for pairing correlations. And here there have been seen a diamagnetic signal using torque magnetometry in above the critical temperature, above TC in YBCO and also other compounds. It's important to note that these results regarding pairing above the critical temperature and the cuprates are contested. Not everybody agrees, but this is actually a plausible scenario to explain these experiments. Another related experimental result which may show pairing correlations without phase coherence above the critical temperature in the cuprate superconductors is the Nernst effect. If you take a system with pairing and you put it in a magnetic field, as we said, you create vortices, and these vortices can respond to a thermal gradient, thereby creating a Nernst signal. So here we see a plot by Ong's group, old results by now, where they see a Nernst effect in LSCO over a large range of temperatures above the critical above the TC. And they related this to vortices. Some claim that in cuprates there is a Nernst signal from superconducting fluctuations, but it's enough to consider some Gaussian fluctuations. You don't need to invoke vortices to describe these. Nevertheless, focusing on the results in LSCO, in a previous work, we have been able to fit actually these results to a model based on vortices, and the fit is not does not fit as well if you take Gaussian fluctuations. So it seems that at least in some of the cuprates, the Nernst signal comes from superconducting and specifically phase fluctuations in type coming from vortices. Now, in this fit, we calculated an analytic expression for the Nernst effect and fit it to the experimental data for different doping. And the only thing that's different between
So there are the fluctuations, right, above the superconducting transition. You can imagine seeing them as vortex loop fluctuations, right?
Mm-hmm.
So these are not the vortex fluctuations you're talking about, or are they? Are you talking about the fluctuations of the melted vortex lattice that would exist at large enough field?
Okay, so what you have here, vortices of... first of all, if you one way to look at the dephasing transition is by creating vortex pairs and vortex anti-vortex pairs. If you take this dephased state and put it in a magnetic field, then you have an imbalance towards one vortices of one sign respect to the other. Essentially, the Nernst effect is the ratio between the number of vortices created by the magnetic field to the number of vortices that were excited thermally. This is the Nernst effect for weak fields. I'm focusing on the weak field limit of the Nernst effect.
Okay.
All right. So there's no vortex lattice. You have just many vortices, some with some imbalance. And this is what you get here.
The large Nernst signal is many thermally excited?
Large Nernst signal will actually be fewer thermally excited. That's why it decays very strongly with temperature. So this is an exponential scale. So, from my personal interpretation, if you have a Nernst signal which decays very strongly, as you increase the temperature, perhaps one of the best candidates to explain that will be a vortex-based signal. Okay. Now, the message I want to take from here is from the fit. The difference between these various fits is the core energy, which enters over here in the exponent. You need to thermally activate these vortices. To get this decay, and I put the extracted core energies on top of the phase diagram over here, just to show that the core energy is more or less 2 or 3 times TC. Now that could sound high, but actually it's a very low energy for vortex. In a BCS superconductor, the vortex core energy is order of the bandwidth; it's the Fermi energy. And here we find that the vortex core has a very low energy. This indicates, I think, the first I think I know pointed it out is Patrick Lee, who said, if you have vortices that have very low energy to excite, you need a very low energy to excite them, it means that inside the vortex, it's not a normal state. You have some kind of competing state created inside the vortex core. Because you destroyed superconductivity, you need to create something with a very close energy, very close to the condensed superconducting state. So this picture of superconducting fluctuations can also support the picture of some kind of other order, like charge density waves. Yeah?
So a quick question. So here we are doing this fit. I wonder how good the fit is if you're not plotting alpha over b at the function t, then you plot logarithmic by alpha times t versus 1 over t. Whether it is going to be a straight line?
Okay, I didn't follow the algebra, but
you can see the equation against the linear.
Right, so you can look at the equation. This is the calculation.
Oh, okay. So you want to do TO times alpha and then take the log.
Right.
It's rather good. It's rather good. Okay. Yeah.
So what kind of theory goes into this equation that you're showing?
So you assume the bi-Huckel regime, where the vortices are kind of independent. No, you kind of ignore correlations between the motion of vortices. And you just calculate the response of the vortex to a thermal gradient.
So you're thinking of this actually as if you actually had a superconductor, right? You're
so,
kind of ignoring the fact that the superconductor has melted somehow.
No, I'm allowing the superconductor has melted via creation of vortex excitations.
Okay.
That's my assumption. So I don't have this. My system has a finite conductivity because of these vortices. So in that sense, I'm not in a superconducting state. Okay. Okay. So this is just to carry me on to the first of all to state the fact that there may be phase fluctuations in the coupe. Yeah.
So if you come back to this transport, right? So are there consequences for other transport, if in that regime, like in terms of Seebeck effect or anything like that? Because then there would be all times, and if you want to stand on the phenomenology, then you have to live with it, right?
Okay, so as far as Seebeck effect, I'm not sure. But one thing we did think about is just electric conductivity, where you don't see this behavior. And expectedly, you should see this behavior. One consequence is that if this does describe what happens in LSCO, for example, that these vortices have to be very fast. So they have a very high mobility. So that essentially, very quickly, just the minute you cross, the second you cross TC, the conductivity is coming from the normal part, not from superconducting fluctuations, not from the fluctuating supercurrents. So that part, I can say that. If this indeed describes LSCO, we have a constraint that these vortices have to have a low core energy and very high mobility, you know, cheap and fast vortices. Yeah, that's kind of a constraint as far as other transport experiments. Yeah.
Actually, I mean, supposedly, you know, suppose we, you know, penetration depth is very large, so we can, you know, set it to infinity, right?
Yeah.
So essentially, we have, you know, a KT transition.
Yeah.
Then, you know, it's supposed to describe something above the KT transition.
It does. Mm-hmm.
Kind of in the disordered phase, but actually, I think, you know, doing like some reliable calculation there is probably rather complicated, right?
So if you go a little bit above TC, so that's why you see. I cannot describe what happens very close to the transition because of the points. What you described, the correlation between vortices is as you get close to TC from above, there are going to be correlations between the vortices. But if you move away, then you have screening, and essentially each vortex moves independently. That's what people call the bi-Huckel regime. It's like a mean field kind of picture. So essentially, you ask what is the overall current profile in which the vortices are moving, and then you solve it self consistently. That's one way to look at it. Okay. So coming back to the competition between charge density waves and superconductivity. So we said that maybe the vortices harbor some kind of other state which competes. Do we have any other signatures for competition? So looking at the X-ray results, going from high temperatures to low temperatures, the signal goes up for the charge density waves. But once you enter the superconducting phase, the signal goes back down again because it seems that superconductivity suppresses the charge density wave fluctuations. And furthermore, if you apply a magnetic field and suppress superconductivity, then you gain more intensity in the charge density wave signal. So this result seems to show that this experiment seems to show that there's competition between these charge density waves and the superconducting state. Another interesting experiment which may indicate competition are these non-equilibrium experiments where they irradiate the sample with terahertz signals. And this creates some kind of C-axis transport, kind of in this perpendicular direction, which looks like coherent transport. It looks like some kind of superfluid supercurrent. And this is even well above the transition temperature. In LBCO, such results were interpreted as melting of this charge order. But maybe also in YBCO, exciting the system, you know, kind of sending these strong radiation pulses onto the system, excite the system, suppress the charge order, and enable the superconducting correlations to express themselves through a coherent transport. So this is another experiment we may show that we have some competition which we can tune via external probes. Now, competition between charge density waves and superconductivity is natural in one-dimensional systems. So a one-dimensional electron gas can be unstable towards, once you open a spin gap, can be unstable towards either superconductivity or charge density waves. Here we have the superconducting order parameter and the charge density wave order parameter written in terms of the Bose fields, which describe these one-dimensional degrees of freedom. And so a spin gap is open, so we get a finite amplitude. And the phase of each of these degrees of freedom, the superconducting order parameter and the charge density wave order parameter, actually conjugate to each other. So this theta c and the phi c are conjugate. So immediately, because quantum mechanically, these two order parameters are incompatible with each other. Either you condense one or you condense the other in one dimension. In one dimension, we don't have long-range order, but this would eventually express itself once you try to couple between one-dimensional systems. Either you'll stabilize a superconducting state or you'll stabilize a charge density wave state, depending on microscopic conditions. So this is to show that competition between superconductivity and charge density waves is natural in some microscopic considerations. But we would like to go away from the microscopics and try to consider a phenomenological model, so I don't have to go far away. Here I have a model which was presented, amongst other places, also by Professor Melko and his group, together with Subir Sachdev. And they considered the following classical model for competing order parameters. So we have a superconducting order parameter, psi, and we have the charge density wave order parameters, phi x and phi y, because the charge density waves could modulate in the x direction, the y direction. Each of these is a complex order parameter, so altogether we have six real components. That's our order parameter. It's a multi-component order parameter. The Hamiltonian is giving as follows, and here we're considering a simple, simplified version. So we have only quadratic terms. The superconducting energy over here coupled to vector potential. Here we have the stiffness of the charge density wave, and we have a mass term for the charge density wave. So these n's are the 3 to 6 are the charge density wave components. We introduce a mass term because we want the ground state of the system to be superconducting. And then additionally, we have a term which couples the charge density wave so to random electrostatic potential. This Hamiltonian itself does not describe competition because each of these degrees of freedom can fluctuate independently. The competition comes from enforcing a constraint that this six-dimensional order parameter has to have a fixed magnitude, which we just set to one. So this makes sure that the different components compete with each other. At high temperatures, all directions on the six-dimensional sphere are equally probable. So you could either be superconducting or charge density wave, it doesn't matter. But once you lower the temperature, because of this mass term, the system would want to be point in the superconducting direction. The system would eventually be a superconductor. So in their paper, they focused on this quantity, which is a structure factor of a two-dimensional clean system. This corresponds to the peak in the X-ray diffraction experiments. And what they were able to show is that were able to reproduce, using Monte Carlo simulations of this model, they were able to reproduce the maximum of this peak as a function of temperature. So you follow the intensity of the X-ray signal at the peak as a function of temperature, and you see this maximum, which we, as we said earlier, this maximum describes the competition. Signal increases, then once you enter the superconducting state, decreases again. So this is what they've did in their paper. We would like to focus on a few other components which we'd like to add to this model. Namely, we want to add magnetic fields, finite magnetic fields to the system. We would like to add a disorder, which is naturally there. Charge density wave will always feel disorder because you always have random electrostatic fields in the system. And we would eventually want to couple between layers to look at a three-dimensional system.
What's the origin of this constraint?
OK, so I don't know. Maybe Max could say a few things about that, because he has some microscopic description of this this competition. But as far as we're, from a phenomenological point of view, we're only considering the competition. So it's just one way to formulate a competition between order parameters. You need a what we don't have really is a microscopic model for that. But from a phenomenological point of view,
I would guess from a phenomenological point of view, you just want another term in your land up theory, which
makes them. Okay, so that's one possibility. So, but that would be not necessarily.
I think one of the ideas is that by imposing this constraint, you can try and distill what is a central contribution of the physics. So it's a bit of an artificial constraint. It's not going to apply up to maybe fairly high temperature, where at some high temperature, the system might be completely unordered. But you're saying that if you sort of fix this constraint, then the physics over this region of the temperature phase diagram might be governed by the fluctuations between these orders.
So the assumption is that we're at low enough temperatures that the system wants to be ordered. It only has to choose. So you know what the amplitude of your order parameter is. It has to just choose a direction. If you put a different kind of competition term, like a fight to the fourth type of term, you're going to allow amplitude fluctuations. We're not focusing on that, because amplitude fluctuations will tell us how much we want to condense. But we are condensed. We're focusing on to which direction we want to condense. And maybe Max wants to add something.
Yeah, thank you. It's just, you have some order. Suppose you had exact symmetry between charge density wave and superconductor. Then at lower temperatures you can describe it by nonlinear sigma model. And now we just add some anisotropy. So I think that's
yeah.
So in the same vein, so if you take let's say the 1D case, which is sharp,
okay,
and then you do something, you couple it in chains in infinite number of dimensions to validate the mean field theory.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens to the structure of that theory there, where Ginzburg-Landau theory? Like, what's the structure of the competition between CW and superconductivity when you start from the weakly coupled chains in 1D, where the definition, the competition is?
That's a very good question. I don't know the answer.
So I wonder, so this is not phase transition, right? So this peak is not describing any thermodynamic phase transition.
Right. Okay. Near this peak, there's a transition to a superconducting state, but at least as far as the experiment is concerned. So somewhere around, very close to this peak, you have a true superconducting transition. But as far as simulations are concerned, there's a Costa-Lis-Taulis transition somewhere over here, kind of a little bit further down, but it's not at the peak. The peak is not from a thermodynamic transition.
So that means the shape is not universal?
Yeah, the shape is not universal. Right?
Okay, but then doesn't mean that it really depend on what the model you work with. And
the shape of the peak may depend on the model. The existence of the peak is probably just comes from the fact that you're discussing a model with competition. So if you have an order parameter competing with superconductivity being the ground state, you're always going to have some kind of maximum, this kind of structure factor as a function of temperature. That's generic. It doesn't have to be. What exactly the functional behavior around the maximum? That's non-universal.
Okay, so there are no sort of exponents that you can extract. So basically, just take this model, simulate it, and you put some parameter and feed the experimental data with the output from this model.
Right. That's essentially what they did. Now there's a previous paper, a collaboration by also. Professor Melko's group and with also a student of Steve Kivelson, who also looked at various variations of this model in the same direction that we did, and they have also similar results. What we actually have here in addition is treating the finite magnetic field case, and that will be important for the rest of the talk. So what are our results?
Coming back to, so in fact, I think this kind of phenomenon must be generic of what's called MN vector models.
Okay.
M over, yeah. So in below the lower critical dimension. When
they don't order, yeah.
They don't order.
Okay.
And so if I imagine I'm close to a multi-critical point where the symmetry is enlarged and I would go there and come in, but I'm just a bit off, right?
Okay.
And I'm marching towards either one phase or the other, as I bifurcate and the system makes its choice, which is near the peak, right? Because you said there's a transition, but it's in the other sector, it's in the superconducting.
Yes, okay.
So the non-ordering field must know its corrections to scaling, right? Close to where the decision is made to order in the other phase, right?
There must be
information about the non-ordering correlation function that knows about what it could have been if it had ordered. Because you were saying that there's no quantitative content in that peak compared to the
case.
But I'm not sure if that's the case, if you're close enough to the...
You're asking, okay, what happens if I set essentially, at the point of critical point, this would be zero.
So you care about the multi-critical point at a fixed temperature. As you come down in temperature, right? But here it's a bit complicated because when it's XY order, there will be a transition, the other one is...
Yeah, okay.
Well, they both break here, right? They both are U1 symmetry, so they have legitimate KT transition in both cases.
Okay, so in principle, yes. In principle, they both will have a KT transition. Regarding a multi-critical point here,
The question is, does this multi-critical point could be controlling the shape of this? That's right. Okay.
Well, we're actually purposely focusing on away from that point, so we're looking at where this mass is finite, and so those universal structures will probably not come into account. Yeah.
I guess if you just go back a slide.
Yeah.
Because the question is, how large is G compared to the to the coefficient of the how large is the anisotropy compared to the coefficient of the kinetic term?
Oh, the kinetic term. Okay. So we take G to be actually in their fits. So G is it's 0.3 or something. It's not small. That's just the lattice spacing. So units, well, just to fix the units. Okay. So what are our results? So we consider an analysis in the charge density wave sector. So we assume we're in low temperatures as far as superconductor is concerned, and we do a large line analysis in the charge density wave sector. So we assume we don't have only four components of a charge density wave, but we have many components of a charge density wave, and that allows us to treat this analytically. And we also have done Monte Carlo simulations. So at the zero magnetic field, at low temperatures, the structure factor would just grow linearly with temperature. And we see here this in the Monte Carlo results. It's a black line of zero magnetic field. At finite magnetic field, the results depend on the order of limits. So if we look at the fix the low temperature and send the magnetic field to zero, then we find a term which an additional term to this linear temperature term, which grows linearly with magnetic field. On the other hand,
this field grows here just in the gauge
field. Yeah. Okay. So. In the Monte Carlo simulations, it couples the gate field. Analytically, I'll describe in a minute how we treat this. In the other limit, where you keep the magnetic field fixed and lower the temperature, we see a divergence. And it's very easy to understand where this divergence comes from, and this is actually how we treat the problem. If you have a superconductor, and we're inside the superconducting phase, and you put a magnetic field, as we said, you create vortices. In the vortices, you destroy superconductivity. And in this model, inevitably, you're going to get the charge density wave in the vortex because of the constraint. So around the center of each vortex, you're going to get a halo of charge density waves. This reminds us of the early scanning STM results of Jennifer Hoffman. As you lower the temperature at a finite magnetic field, you're going to get the charge density wave halos are going to talk to each other, and they're going to order. I'm going to have longer and longer correlations between further and further vortex core halos centered around the vortex cores. So this drives the structure factor eventually to diverge. How does it diverge? It depends on this overlap between the shape of the halo, the wave function of the halo and one vortex and the other vortex. It's just like tight binding. Essentially, this is how you solve the problem. You solve a tight binding model for the charge density wave localized inside these vortex cores. So that's why we denoted this overlap with T, because we have some kind of intuition of what that means. So you get this divergence at low temperatures and find a magnetic field. The thing is that this does not show up in the experiment. First of all, at zero magnetic field, the structure factor does not go to zero. It goes to some finite value. And at finite magnetic field, we don't have the divergence. So to cope with this discrepancy, we have to introduce something else to the model. And one thing that was proposed is to include disorder, which has to be there. So we just assume we have a random electric static field which couples linearly to this charge density wave degrees of freedom. Analytically, we could treat this in the weak disorder limit using a replica method. And we could also run simulations. And indeed, we find that at zero magnetic field, the structure factor goes to a finite value at low temperatures. And it doesn't diverge. And this looks rather similar to what was seen in experiment in the X-ray scattering. OK?
There's no lambda theory where charge density wave and supernatural wave can coexist. That's like seen in the beta.
In the ground state? I don't know.
By the way, you started by definition, I can't.
Okay, so yeah, we started with a model where the ground where the ground state of the clean system is superconducting. Yes.
I think if you just set your G to zero, actually, you could find that you coexist.
But for example, if you set your G to zero, your system
somewhere in the middle between superconductivity and you spontaneously choose anywhere in your any vector direction, some of it would be some portion of superconducting, some portion would be.
Yes.
It's like the G is going to zero, you would get something that would be more, you wouldn't have to invoke disorder.
I think we would get many other things if you set G to zero, because essentially that's a quantum phase transition. And so now if you go beyond the model, so if you consider.
Just within your model, you set G equals to zero. It'll spontaneously choose some direction which will have some portion superconducting, some portion.
Okay, so why? But you won't get this peak. You won't get the maximum of the function of temperature. It won't decrease unless it somehow depends non-trivially on temperature. So this this indicates that there is competition. So if there is competition, G has to be finite.
This means that they're struggling for their energy. The fact that they can exist together doesn't mean they're that competitive. They're not really.
Okay.
Is the level order if you set G2? Is the level order at finite temperature?
Oh, we're never order at all, yes. Because you lose the U1.
Well, in three dimensions, it cannot.
That's not experimentally relevant, right? I mean, there's always going to be a crossover that could take over and make it order, which is not in the model, right? The Mermann-Wagner theorem is not relevant expanding.
But you also wouldn't get a KT transition.
Right? In two dimensions, no. But if G is zero, you will get some kind of ordering in three-dimensional system.
So I don't know if that's a fair question, but your comment about the it doesn't order in large field, is it? How does that story change with the Stanford results, the pulse X-ray experiment?
Okay, so I'm going to discuss what happens with strong magnetic fields.
Okay.
I don't know if I'm having specifically those results. Those are relatively new results. But other results will show that perhaps there is something happening at large magnetic fields. And I'll get to that. Right, just before I get to that, I just want to say that increasing this order has a similar result to applying a magnetic field in the sense that a magnetic field localizes some kind of region, a charge density wave region around the vortex. If you have a magnetic field, you're going to have some place a strong random electrostatic field which would want to attract to itself some kind of charge order, which is somehow attracted, you know, to attract, you can somehow have a local potential well which likes to have a charge density wave inside it. So if you increase this order, eventually you obliterate this maximum as a function of temperature and you just get an increase in the signal which saturates at low temperatures. And this may explain what happened, the absence of a maximum as a function of temperature in the mercury compounds, where you just see this signal increasing and then saturating. So it just may be not because there's no competition, just because you have a large disorder in the system. That's one explanation to how to describe the results in the mercury-based compounds. Okay. What we've done up till now is consider short-range order. So we have two-dimensional system with short-range order. That's what we did up till now. But there are experiments that show that perhaps we have long-range order in long-range charge density wave order. One of these experiments are ultrasound attenuation results, where they saw a change in the velocity of sound as a function of magnetic field. So you increase the magnetic field, and suddenly you see this anomaly. They call it anomaly. So, and the interpretation is that the state of the system is changing when the magnetic field is strong enough. And they attribute it to a static long-range charge order. And using these results, they can draw the phase, the region in the phase diagram where you have long-range order. So you need to reach a finite magnetic field and as long as your temperatures are not too high. And there are also other experiments that show this. For example, NMR experiments also show some line splitting at finite magnetic fields. So again, you increase magnetic field, you enter a order, long-range order state. If you have long-range charge density wave order, you're changing your translation symmetry of the system. And if you have charges moving around and they're large Fermi surface, like in the cuprates, will have to fold onto itself because the Brillouin zone is reduced if you reduce the symmetry, the translation symmetry due to charge modulations. This would create small electron and hole pockets. And if you have small electron and hole pockets, you should see the signature of that, and indeed they have in quantum oscillation experiments. So for example, here we see the hole resistivity as a function of the inverse magnetic field, and you see here high frequency quantum oscillations which correspond to small electron pockets. So this is an indication that we have some kind of long-range charge modulation which reconstructs the Fermi surface. Other indication, experimental indications to the fact that the Fermi surface changes its shape or is reconstructed come from the change in the Hall coefficient sign. So at high temperatures, the Hall coefficient is positive because we have Hall carriers. But if we reduce the temperature and apply a strong enough magnetic field, they find a Hall coefficient which is negative. So this is actually an indication, again, that at strong enough magnetic fields and low enough temperatures, we have a long-range charge density wave order. And also similar results in Nernst effect. So we have a switch in sign, and Nernst effect also may indicate a reconstruction of Fermi surface. So we would like to study long-range order in this model. So we take the original model and couple between layers. Some kind of capacitive coupling is enough. And we could do a mean field analysis between interlayer mean field analysis and get a constraint, a condition for the transition temperature into the charge density wave order. This is a kind of a mean field equation which will tell us what is the transition temperature in and what are the fields required to get a transition to to the long range order state. Graphically, this mean field condition can be explained as follows. We add the transition occurs when the structure factor, which we showed earlier for the two-dimensional system, crosses this straight line. At zero magnetic field, we don't necessarily have a crossing. The only place where to get a transition at zero magnetic field, we need a finite coupling between the layers. So here we have results of a multilayer Monte Carlo simulations for the multilayer, for a three-dimensional system, and we see that there's no transition, no TC is zero, up to a finite value of the coupling between the layers. But once we turn on a magnetic field, because of this divergence in the structure factor, because the super charged density wave halos start talking to each other, any small coupling is enough to create a transition into a charged long-range charged density wave state. So to summarize our multi-layer results, the mean field result is for any finite magnetic field, we expect for any finite magnetic field and small coupling between the layers, we expect a transition. And this is not what they say you'll see in experiment. In experiments, you need a finite magnetic field to enter the long-range state. So again, like before, we're asking what can we add to the model to overcome the discrepancy with experiment, and again, we'll think of this order again. The problem is,
this interrail coupling has to be roughly the same strength as this mass feature.
Okay. So what happens here? If
that
yeah,
mass potential.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. So actually, the whole system turns to charge density wave. It's not because of the coupling between the layers. So you're actually overcoming the mass. Yeah. Exactly. And that's not the case in the finite magnetic field. For this transition. This transition is a transition within the halos. Okay. The problem is that for a continuous order parameter coupled linearly to a random field, there's a theorem by Imri and Ma that there cannot be any long-range order. To understand this, we only have to understand that domains can be created. The system wants to create domains. So the domain wall energy for continuous order parameter scales like d to the minus 2, and the energy gained by aligning a domain of size L to in a certain direction scales like L d over 2. And this, as a result, for any dimension below 4, we'll always want to create domains. So there's no real long-range order. But nevertheless, there are experimental indications which show there is long-range order.
But
yeah.
That's not necessarily correct for U1 symmetry, right?
For U1 symmetry?
Yeah.
U1 symmetry should be correct. I think. But
no, because this is you can estimate where domains is. So there's a lot of correction here because of when you start to have topological defects that really destroy the order, and they come log in the potential further to the question.
For U1. Okay.
So the belief by a number of people is that in three dimension, mm-hmm. you'd have algebraic orders.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So it's not.
Yeah, okay.
So I don't know if it changes the story, but.
It doesn't, because actually we're going to ignore this. I'm going to ask the following question. we're going to ask a question. Let's put aside the problem of really truly long range order. Let's ask, when is there a crossover? Okay, so the mean field conditions will tell us when do we have a crossover to a longer range order, which could be algebraic. It could be just have a finite length scale, but just very large. And you talk to experimentalists; they don't care about Imri and Ma. They see signatures for long range order. So we're actually going to ask, what is a crossover condition? What are the conditions for a crossover to a longer range order than the pure two-dimensional picture we were describing earlier? Yeah.
I'd say experiments would really indicate longer range order, not long range order as well.
Yeah. Okay.
So from the X-ray refraction experiments, in this high field state, it has a finite correlation length, finite width peak. It's not resolution limited or anything that we would think is really truly long range order.
Yeah.
Just relative to the shorter range glassy stuff, I don't know. So when people say long range order, they're stretching a bit.
Yeah.
Okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in the disordered case, the mean field condition graphically looks as the following. We ask, when does this this is not the structure factor anymore, but it's some kind of response function, charge response function. When does this response function cross this line linear in T? And we see that it always happens for the same magnetic field over a large range of temperatures. So essentially, this means, turning the reasoning around, to enter the charge at low temperatures, to enter the charge, the longer range order, we always have to overcome some finite magnetic field, which is roughly temperature dependent up to higher temperatures. And we can create, we can reproduce a phase diagram which has a longer range three-dimensional charge density wave order in low temperatures and high magnetic fields. And this seems to agree also with, so this is the blue dots come from the mean field condition, and the red points are just simulations of a three-dimensional model. And these two approaches agree with each other. And they look rather similar to what is claimed from the experiments, that you have this phase over beyond the finite magnetic field. Going further, so if we look, for example, at the structure factor of the three-dimensional system as a function of magnetic field, it starts to grow fast once we go beyond the magnetic field. This is similar to this red curve seen in the X-ray experiments. And also, if you look at the correlation length, it kind of tends to saturate beyond this magnetic field. And this is also what they see in experiment. So this picture of a disordered system, three-dimensional system, seems to be consistent with crossover into a longer range state, ordered state in three dimensions. And that's what they seem to see in experiment. Any questions at this point? So, whoops, sorry about that. Oh, come on. Yeah, I just want to go back. This would be almost my conclusion, that we can actually reproduce this phenomenology of transition to long-range order within this phenomenological model of a nonlinear sigma model. I just want to step back and ask, let's go back to phase fluctuations again. So we have this model which successfully describes the charge density wave signatures and seen in experiment. But what happens to phase fluctuations? Are there phase fluctuations in this model? Now, there have to be phase fluctuations because there's a superconducting order parameter, and it's fluctuating classically. There's nothing that will prevent the superconducting order parameter to fluctuate at high temperatures. We can study this by, instead of focusing on the charge density wave order, which we've done throughout the, presenting these results, we could trace out the charge density wave degrees of freedom and reproduce the energy landscape for the order, the superconducting order parameter. And in many under many conditions, we're going to find that it has a finite amplitude and a phase which has to be determined thermodynamically. So for example, in the superconducting phase, you have find the superconducting phase where you have the phase is fixed and you have long-range phase coherence. If you increase the temperature, we cross the Kostelis-Taurus transition where you have phase fluctuations but a finite pairing amplitude. Eventually, as we increase the temperature more, we're going to enter a regime of Gaussian fluctuations. The question is, how large is the regime for phase fluctuations? So that depends on the microscopic parameters. So actually, the reason I got into this model is I met Subir Sachdev and told him the story we had about the Nernst effect with vortices. And I said, well, it should have also happened in this O6 model. He said, yes, but only a very, very narrow range of temperatures. So if lambda is small, lambda is the stiffness of the charge density wave, then you're going to have a small range, or phase fluctuations would be reported only over a small range of temperatures. But if you increase the stiffness of the charge density wave, this region where you see phase fluctuations could be larger. And this will have signatures, for example, in Nernst effect, as we described before, and also in ARPES experiments. I expect that we would see the effect of phase fluctuations will naturally be observed in spectral signatures of the electrons in these systems. So After we describe this model, use this model to describe the charge density wave, I just want to say, go back and say that it may be a little bit early, and I'm talking to those of you who are aware of the controversy regarding this interpreting various experiments. It may be a little bit early to dismiss this picture of phase fluctuations altogether, and there may be various experimental signatures where phase fluctuations are important. Yeah.
How do you integrate out the charge density wave fields when you have this constraint?
A large n, a saddle point approximation. Yeah. Okay. So it's more or less time to conclude. So to summarize, it seems that the nonlinear sigma model of competing orders could capture much of the phenomenology of in the coupe rates. This order seems to be essential in explaining the results in YBCO, and perhaps could explain the different behavior in the mercury-based coupe rates. And it seems that the apparent ordering transition is actually a crossover into from a short range correlations to a longer range ordered state between layers. That's it.
Any questions?
Yes.
Yeah. Go back a couple slides to your comparison of the long range and short range order. Yeah, here. So in experiments, it seems that there's a bit of a coexistence of high fields of a short range order and a longer range.
You're also talking about these two different wave vectors.
There's different wave vectors in sort of. So is that something that appears in your model as well? That you kind of still have a remnant of something short range? Plus, you get something longer?
In the model itself, no, because we're kind of probing variations around only a certain point in momentum space. So we're looking at a single peak in the X-ray scattering and seeing how it, what are the fluctuations about that point. Dror, my thesis advisor, has actually been trying to see whether you could get something like that. For example, if you have competing antiphase coupling between layers and phase coupling, this could this half and one wave vectors in YBCO could explain that, but not in the context of this model. I don't know if it's possible. You probably have to go to something more microscopic to capture these results.
What if you introduced a nematicity into the model? Would that kind of affect things? Would that be a the difference between X versus the Y and CDW order?
Okay, so if you have ordering, then it would choose a channel, and you're always going to have an orthogonal channel which doesn't order. So it could be X plus Y, it could be X minus Y, it could just be X or Y, and perhaps you would get, for the orthogonal channel which doesn't order, you may have this short range correlations. But that's not what they see in the experiment, because these differences are in the C direction, the C axis.
On experiments, there's a difference between A and the B axes.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So there's sort of peak widths. Yeah, the peak widths to some extent. So there's some, at this stage, not very well understood C4 symmetry breaking going on.
Yeah, that could be naturally cinematic. When we put that aside, because we really wanted to focus on the competition without the detailed structure of the competing order, which does definitely have much more structure in it than what we considered.
So with only a fluctuating charge density wave, this incident charge density wave, would you see a Nernst effect in the pseudogap regime?
You would have Nernst effect coming from superconducting fluctuations, yes.
So let's say I turn off superconductivity altogether in the pseudo gap phase, and I would keep this incident.
If it's a short range order, I would bet it's very weak, because if a normal metal has a very weak Nernst effect, if
that's
at all,
right, that's right.
Yeah. So I would guess that if your charge density wave correlations are short range, you won't be much different from the metallic case in that sense. If you increase the magnetic field and stabilize a long-range order system and reconstruct your Fermi surface, then perhaps you would get a significant inert signal. And I think essentially that's what they see at large magnetic fields. Large magnetic fields, they're not probing anymore the superconducting fluctuations. And the inertia effect at large magnetic fields, I think, does come from quasi-particles in this reconstructed Fermi surface.
Right, but I wonder how large you have to go to actually kill off supernovae by magnetic field, because they have an enormous HC2, if I remember right. Like, so.
Well, what exactly HC2 is in those systems is also debated. If you look at these fields over here, you didn't destroy superconductivity altogether, but your vortices are rather dense already. So perhaps the more significant contribution in that case would come from the quasi-particles on the reconstructed Fermi surface.
Okay, so a more realistic scenario would be have both fluctuating superconductivity and some incipient CW, right? So in your previous calculation where you only considered vortices contribution to blur signal, if I understand right, the assumption is that the vortices are so fast, they are essentially free particles propagating system. So there, I don't see any mobility of the vortices entering the expression, so that's my...
Okay, so in this, specifically in this model, we're considering equilibrium, so the dynamics, so the we don't consider dynamics, and we didn't consider dissipative dynamics of the degrees of freedom. You could introduce it again phenomenologically, but then it would just be another parameter, like the vortex mobility. My claim that the vortices have to be fast is just because, not because they have to be fast, is because if they exist and they don't give a signature in just in the regular electric conductivity, then they must be fast. Okay, so if you have fluctuating vortices and you don't see them in conductivity, they must be very fast, and that's why. And the difference between Nernst effect and electric conductivity is that the Nernst effect, the relaxational terms cancel, and in the conductivity they don't. So if you have the vortices will show themselves in the Nernst effect just because they're there, and you won't see them if they're very fast in conductivity measurements. In electric conductivity.
So the fluctuating CW affect the nursing, in a way that basically changes this free vortex feature.
You would get a contribution from quasi particles in this charge density wave. I don't know to tell you exactly what the contribution is going to be. There are some results which show, for example, that if you have a symmetry broken various density states, then the Nernst signal could have various signs depending. You have to fine tune your parameters to get a specific result. It's not generic.
Okay. I think we can stop here. So let's thank you again.
Thank you very much.